This is the moment when we go to the phones, 1-800, and speak to yourself as loud as you can. In the yellow t-shirt, way back.
Okay, the question was, to what extent are our expansionist, militarist, whatever you want to call it, tendencies being driven by looking for markets for capitalism? I think you want to be much more crude about that. It's not about opening up the Iraqi market. And by the way, I think if you ask, usually when you look at one of these policies, it's got multiple explanations. There are multiple constituencies. So part of the Iraq war was about Karl Rove looking for a midterm election issue. Part of it was about neocon dreams of transforming the Middle East and some of it even personal. I think some of these guys felt that their manhood was impaired when Saddam got away in 91. So they had to come back and deal with that one. And part of it, I don't think it was, let's put this, I don't think that Iraq was a war for Halliburton. But I do think that the policy, it got some boost from the fact that Halliburton and others saw the possibility of big profits. And I do think I'm not sure that there was any way it would have gone well, but I do think that the mess of the post-war handling has been even worse than it had to be because, among other things, because decisions were warped by the prophets. I think that in those first few weeks after the fall of Baghdad, Europe might have well gotten itself involved. They would have been sorry, but they might well have gotten themselves involved. And the U.S. turned them away because Halliburton didn't want to share the profits. There's a very good piece in Slate just today about how we mucked up things that shouldn't have been mucked up, like the new cell phone network. But that's because the contract had to go to MCI. And there are a lot of... So it's much cruder stuff. You don't want to think about class things or corporations as a group. You want to think about specific companies and specific contracts, and then it becomes a story.
A lot of hands. Please.
The question is, who's going to get us enraged about the class war, about the policies? Who's going to mobilize the ordinary American? I think if you had... Let's put it this way. My mystical faith in America, which I have some mornings anyway, most people thought, if you'd asked people in 1932, Franklin Roosevelt was widely regarded as a lightweight, a kind of privileged upper-class twit, and he turned out to be something rather more than that. I'd like to hope that buried inside of the man of the next president is our next FDR. Although, on the other mornings, I think about what the military says, which is that hope is not a plan. But let's just hope that we really have that man or woman waiting inside someone.
Black shirt in the balcony.
Okay. Questions about media ownership and whether that has adversely affected the willingness of the media to tell the truth. Okay. One piece is very clear. Anything owned by Rupert Murdoch is just part of the machine. Anything owned by the Reverend Moon is part of the machine. And that's a big part. That's a lot. That's a large part of where the public gets its news is just blatantly, it's Orwellian, of course, fair and balanced. If I say this often enough, will Fox sue me? That's what I need, anyway. Now, for the rest, it's interesting. The truth is, I don't know. I don't have any evidence that the corporate ownership is affecting the coverage. That doesn't mean that it isn't, but I can't point to examples. So is it the case that the big conglomerates that own all the major television news sources have actually put probably subtle pressure on journalists to cover some things and not? It is, if I were a literary theorist, I'd say the problem is it's overdetermined. There's also 9/11. There's also the flag waving. There's also the personal intimidation that journalists face. So I don't quite know. It's certainly something to be worried about.
Please.
The question is, what isn't calling Bush the CEO president, as he did, itself a critique? Well, in particular, to the extent he was, which he wasn't really, but to the extent that Bush was a CEO, he was one of those CEOs. Nothing I've written has generated as much hatred as talking about Bush's own extremely dubious business career. And no, it's an amazing thing that that as it happens, he essentially replicated in miniature all of the things that we later discovered were prevalent throughout corporate America: self-dealing, insider sales, highly questionable compensation schemes, the whole thing. And it's I will never understand. No, I sort of understand, but I don't really understand why during the 2000 campaign that just didn't come up. The information was out there. Joe Connison reported on it. The mainstream press just wouldn't pick it up. And I reproach myself for being at that point too high-minded to go after it. It should have been in the campaign. Okay. Question is, hasn't there been a plutocratic coup d'état, and why aren't they concerned about their place in history, and why do they want more money? I wouldn't say we've had a plutocratic coup d'état. I'd say we had a plutocratic, theocratic, militaristic coup d'état. No, it's not just one thing. I mean, it's important to understand that there are multiple things going on, and that's what gives it so much power. In terms of the, you do wonder, I mean, why, just take the, why would Grasso do that to himself? He has to, unless he's completely a fool, he has to have known that the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, whose handpicked compensation committee gave him $140 million and destroyed his career in the process. He has to have known that was a risk. Why be that greedy? But I think those of us who aren't can't understand there's a kind of a selection. If you aren't supernally greedy, you don't get to those positions in the first place. And it's just, like the end of the movie Chinatown, with the right where he says, "Why would you do all that?" And he says, "For the future." And you never understand what it is he means, but you're not supposed to. The filthy rich are different from you and me. It is a funny thing because you do wonder. I do actually ask the question without answering it in the intro to the book. I'd say that the '90s were a very good time to be rich. So why this demand for even more? It was a very good time to be. Religious denominations were flourishing, demand for totality, and the U.S. was the greatest power the world had ever known. Why feel that we needed to go out there and prove our might by invading fifth-rate powers? But it's clear it's there, that they just want more, and it's not appealing to the better angels of their nature, I don't think is going to solve this problem.
In the pink shirt at the very back, by the pillar.
Okay, question was, how are federal budget projections calculated, and as the economy grows, won't the deficits be reduced? Okay, now there are two kinds of projections that you will see out there. There are the projections that are done, the formally, legally required projections of the Congressional Budget Office, which are obliged to assume that the law as written, exactly as written, will prevail. And under those, the deficit does go down because many of the tax cuts that were passed have sunset clauses and they go away. And there's nothing in law that says we're going to be spending $100 billion a year in Iraq forever. Then there are projections that make reasonable assumptions about that the tax cuts will not be allowed to sunset, that make reasonable assumptions about spending. And the important point is that the serious projections show only a modest decline in the deficit, even if and when the economy recovers, because we're talking really, really big deficits here, and only a small fraction of it can be attributed to the fact that the economy is depressed, so it doesn't go away. And after 10 years, a little bit less than 10 years now, baby boomers start hitting Medicare and Social Security, so that any reasonable forecast, and basically everyone now says that, everyone who isn't specifically on the payroll now says this, we're looking at $400 billion plus deficits for the next 10 years, and then it gets worse. The Comptroller General of the United States gave a press conference in which he talked about how bad the budget outlook is, and somebody, he has to be rigorously nonpartisan, he kind of lost it for a minute there. Someone asked, but don't the president and the vice president say that they are still deficit hawks? And he said, can't tell that from the numbers. And then when laughter broke out in the room, he sort of realized he'd stepped over a line, but he couldn't help himself.
Last question. Yes, young lady in the dark shirt.
Please. The question is about Governor Riley's attempt to reform Alabama's taxes, which went down to overwhelming defeat in a referendum last weekend, I guess. It's a very sad story. This is a conservative Republican governor with a deep budget hole, like most governors, who said there's no way to resolve. We already have one of the worst education systems in the country. We need more revenue. We can't cut more. And then said, as long as we're going to raise more revenue, let's also reform this dreadful tax system we have, under which poor people pay 11% of their income in state and local taxes, and rich people pay 2% of their income. And actually, most states are kind of like that, though Alabama is one of the worst. And the other side pulled out all the stops. They hired people with rural black accents to make radio ads saying this will raise your taxes, which of course it wouldn't. It would have lowered taxes for the people hearing those ads. And they got everybody saying it's unchristian to reduce taxes on the poor. And it went down to overwhelming defeat. And it's just it's a reminder. Now, there should have been. There should have been a national rallying around Riley, around the plan, and there wasn't. And maybe I'm at fault, although I have to say there just wasn't time to say something. But it should have been. This civil rights groups should have been mobilizing for this. Everyone should have been trying to do something. But it is a reminder of how powerful the propaganda machine can be, and it can just lie flat and convince a lot of people.
Paul Krugman, thank you for the work you do, man.